Hello, this is Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today was born in Alexandria, Egypt, and is an American memoirist, essayist, novelist, and scholar of 17th century literature. His work has appeared in distinguished publications all over the world. He teaches comparative literature at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. He's the New York Times best-selling author of Call Me By Your Name, now an award-garlanded movie. Out of Egypt, Eight White Nights, False Papers, Alibis, and Harvard Square, and most recently, Enigma Variations. Andre Aspen, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. We're so thrilled that not only you're in this studio, you're in Britain and you're giving a whole series of talks, and it's just wonderful to have you here with this luminous book.
Thank you. You know that being in Britain is very important for me.
Why?
Because I went to British schools all through my childhood, and the itinerary of my life was going to end up in the UK, in London specifically, and it never happened. So it was what they call a rendezvous manqué. So basically, my life took a different course.
Well, of course, because you grew up, I mean, you were born in Alexandria, as
That's
we know,
right.
But then moved around a great deal, and central to that was your father. Tell me about your father, whom you've written about. What a fascinating man.
My father was a womanizer, but I think he was more than just a womanizer. He was also a businessman. He was a great reader who influenced my taste in literature sort of for the rest of my life, which means that my children have been influenced by me in the same way with my father's ideas. He was a very original man who basically, I think, did not believe in taboos, which was the best thing about him. Because when you grow up with a father who does not believe in particularly ethical or specifically sexual taboos, you feel very liberated. You can do anything, say anything you want, particularly with other people. And there is nothing that stops you back, holds you back, unless you have bad manners, which was very important for him. So you have very good manners and at the same time, very loose morals.
Very loose morals, which took him to many places. Tell me about being forced to leave. And I mean, you write about it in your 1994
yes.
memoir, Out of Egypt. You describe how you have to leave your mother's house, your father's factory, your favorite bicycle. Everything is suddenly gone.
Yes, it's all taken from you. And then you get a call that says you have to leave the country within 2 weeks, which is very generous because the Brits and the French, when they had to leave in 56, were given 7 days. So you leave everything behind, which is unthinkable. I mean, you leave behind everything you own because you can't even take it with you. You're not allowed to. So anything you grew up with that you're attached to is gone. All you have are just photographs. Those at least you can take with you. And separating from something that, see, I never liked living in Egypt because I was already a foreigner in Egypt. By the time I was, 14, I felt very much like I was a foreigner.
Because you were Jewish?
Because I was Jewish, because I was Italian, because I had been Turk before, I had been a Turk before that, and because I associated with anything French and British. I mean, there was nothing Egyptian about me and in the culture except in our kitchen where the servants were, and they were Egyptian. They were very friendly and I loved them. So, but that was sort of the essence of it. So basically, you have a whole culture in a city that is itself multicultural at its core, and you have to abandon the whole thing and never see anything like it again. The group of friends you have all been sort of disbanded and scattered around the world. The family members are all over the world. Nothing has any coherence, and you feel that you are alone in the world, and you have no sort of no lodestar, no direction, and you feel totally unhinged.
And what you do have, though, apart from your photographs, are your memories. And those are something that you seem to be able to tap into incredibly clearly. I mean, in your memoir about that time of your life, it really is as if you're back walking down those streets again.
Yes.
Do you feel that?
I did feel it when I was writing it, because when I was writing my memoir, I really had to put myself back in Alexandria. And suddenly, when you do that and you really tap into your memories, as particularly sensuous memories of the senses of touch, of smell, of feel, you suddenly find yourself remembering things that you had totally forgotten. So 30 years later, you suddenly, things begin to erupt in you that you remember. And when I started writing about my experience at a college, a school called Victoria College, which had become the horror of my life because they used to beat me every single day, if not among the kids, then the teachers would, because I couldn't do my homework, because I couldn't learn anything. At that point, I was so totally sort of broken down that I had a very hard time reading, sort of writing that particular section of my book, because it was very, I mean, I was sort of paranoid at some point, because that old paranoia had suddenly resurfaced with all the other good memories as well.
Mm. And those good memories, so many of them pinned upon your father and on this, yes, this amazing man who, as you say, really encouraged you to think a little bit further, not to be boxed in by those kind of, I suppose I would call them, middle-class morals.
Yes.
In terms of that, and the fact that your work is so wonderfully sexual, I'm not sure you would use that particular
word. It is,
word.
Yes.
I wondered about sex and your first experiences.
Oh, my first experience of sex? Oh, gosh, the very first one was not a good one, not a happy one. But it was supported by my whole family. I mean, they all knew that they were giving me money to go to visit a prostitute. And my father was very open about this, and so was my grandmother, his mother. So there was absolutely no taboo. It was something one did. And, of course, the first time I went, I was so terrified. And I was with other people. They were sort of laughing about it, but I was petrified. And, of course, you had to go through it. It's like an initiation rite, a hazing, which is not pleasant. But you go through it and you fail abominably. And then you have to go back again to prove to yourself that at least you're not a total failure. And by then you sort of adopt. It's like having scotch the first time. You hate it. The third time you begin to like it. And the next thing you know, you're an alcoholic. But basically, it took three sessions for me to feel, okay, now I get what this is all about.
And that experience was with a woman?
Yes.
Would you class yourself as sexually fluid?
I think my writing is. I don't think I am. I think about many things. Many things cross my mind, but not in practice, no. But I understand fluidity. I have a lot of students who are themselves totally trans, and I understand that because I don't like identities and I don't like having a label. But in my personal life, it's more or less sort of very bourgeois.
Not liking identities, it is something, though, that you've written a lot about.
A lot, because that's where I practice it, on paper. Many of the things I do that I mean something to me occur on paper, and many things, not just sexual things. It's the paper that allows me to expand on things that could have happened to me, might have happened, might still happen, but probably won't because I'm too scared, but at the same time, I want them to. You know, that's exactly where I live, in that kind of in-between zone where things are not defined.
Mm. And I wonder about where you actually live, because all of this moving around obviously has an impact. You've ended up in New York, but I mean, you wrote False Papers, which was all about exile,
yes,
and memory. And I wonder if there is a place where you feel you belong. You've been back to Alexandria. It didn't do it for you.
No, absolutely not. I don't think there's any place in particular that feels like home. But I always walk in different cities all my life. I've traveled quite a bit. And I like to sort of look at cities and say, can I live here? Can I live there? And I remember, I was just discussing this morning. I mean, being in England is not another place to be in for me. It is really where my whole schooling was going to take me. So walking down London streets, it feels very much like, yes, I could see very well Andre living here, having grown up here, having gone to school here, having become sort of a citizen here. It makes sense to me. But ultimately, there is no place that feels like home.
Do you think that's a Jewish thing? I mean, you've written about, you said something like being a Jew, you lose something at least twice.
Yes, yes.
And the fact that there are Jews everywhere, but Jews never quite, speaking as a Jew myself, okay, that you never quite fit in.
No, I think that Jews are by themselves. If they do fit in completely, they stop being Jewish. In other words, the aspect of Judaism that makes you a Jew, I'm talking, of course, very colloquially, is precisely the feeling that you have another home. It's not necessarily elsewhere, but it's not here. Mm. So you feel always it's slightly bit dislodged. And that becomes a definition of your identity. I am the dislodged person. I may live here. I may have lived here for 50 years, as I have in New York. I have a family here. I have a wife here. I have children. I have everything is here. And yet, you know, if you remove this place from me and give me another, I'll have to readapt. It'll become my home again. I know it will. We lose everything we own at least twice in our lives. And I love the at least because you lose everything. Once is for sure, twice maybe, and maybe more.
The suitcase by the door.
Yes. Yeah.
One thing that's a constant for every writer and for every reader, I think, is the classics. And for you, that's Proust and Thucydides.
Yes, thank you.
Tell us about Thucydides in particular, because you're very keen on the fact that that the classics are really what matter.
Yes. Well, that again, let me just paraphrase this, go back a few seconds. It's my father. Again, my father was a great reader of the ancients, but also he liked the moderns as well. He had read all the moderns, and he hated Balzac, and he hated Zola. Those are two authors that I cannot abide either because of it's been sanctioned this way, though I've read them. I'm not big fans. But there was something about my father's taste which I have acquired, and I think this is where we connect, though I'm not sure, because we never really discussed this particular connection. He was interested in human psychology. In what, and I am too. In other words, Dostoevsky, Thucydides, Stendhal, Proust, all these writers are essentially depicting human moments in which a person is undecided and needs to make a decision and does not have the wherewithal to make that decision with. And so he needs to extract information from around him and from within him, and he's unable to. And this moment of sort of what you might call psychological paralysis is what I adore. Mm. It's what happens in my case when I write. In romance, you're with somebody that you clearly are attracted to. You don't quite know if they're attracted to you. You need to understand before you make a stand. And basically, you're asked to make a stand without knowing exactly what the other person feels, because you'll never know unless you speak. Mm. And it is this reading and misreading the other and yourself that gives, I think, some of the things I write their amplitude, in the sense that I want to examine how someone excavates himself and his desires, and at the same time, is not always able to read what those desires are.
And did you get a deeper understanding of how that worked, particularly in Proust, in your book, The Proust Project, because you had a lot of people there talking about or writing about what that literature meant to them?
Yes, I have a feeling of what Proust is about, but I think I have the same feeling with Thucydides. It's the same thing. It's that they're interested in other people and reading other people. How do you understand other people? How do you double guess or triple guess what it is that they have in their mind so that you can act accordingly? Mm. How do you infer what they're really saying when they're smiling at you and look so benign? And that at the same time, why is it that you can't trust them? It's not only coming from you. So there is a dynamic, a back and forth, back and forth, back and forth that goes on many layers. And that happens in Thucydides and in Proust and in Stendhal and in Dostoevsky, just to give you a few names.
And not in contemporary writing?
Oh, gosh.
Well, because I know that you famously don't read contemporary authors.
I don't, because I find their style to be very reportage. In other words, they're really not doing fiction. They're using fiction to do journalism. And it's not the same thing. Fiction is supposed to, I believe, and I would like to think, its mission is to make us see things about ourselves that we normally see but have never considered before. Mm. And so the job of the writer is essentially to look at himself first and examine himself so that you can look at him through his lens so that you can look back at yourself. And if a writer does not know how to write in a certain way that allows you to say, I'm going with his rhythm, and I mean the rhythm of the words themselves, I'm going with his sentences, and there are too many commas, but I understand why. And this rhythm is going to carry me away from myself into him, and lo and behold, now I'm coming back to myself because he's allowed me to make that inference about myself. And I never knew this unless I would have been reading him.
And I've come back a changed person.
Yeah. Well, you do change. If an author is particularly powerful, they do change you. They have to change you. That's the point. We don't want to put down a book and say, okay, I've enjoyed this tremendously. I've met some great characters. Now I'm going to go back to work the same person I was before I read this book. That's not it. That's bathroom reading.
You also change how we feel about places, I think. I mean, for instance, the Mediterranean, Italy, completely comes alive in your work, but it's not because you're describing every wonderful hillside and olive grove.
I hate descriptions like that. Even my travel writing, when I used to write for magazines that are travel magazines, I never used to describe anything. But I want people to, again, to infer the place. I can say that there is a smell of lavender and rosemary. And that's all I'll say. But you have to hear the birds chirping. You have to hear the croaking of the whatever it is that croaks. And you have to infer the rest because I allow you to do that. Mm. But I won't take my time to describe. I don't describe faces. But everybody has a very different but identical sense of who Oliver looks like. And yet I have never described him at all.
So it must make it quite hard then when a book like Call Me By Your Name is made into a film, because suddenly all of that hard work that the reader was doing, filling in those details themselves, is there on the screen. It makes it a different beast, really.
Well, that's what the terrible word that is used nowadays and people don't want to use it is adaptation, is that a film takes the story and makes it visual, whereas in fact the story is entirely internal and not visual. How does a director not cheat the author of that? That I think that's where the genius of the movie director lies, is that he has not cheated me. In other words, everything that Elio, the character, and who is the narrator, feels, is now has to be on his face. He cannot speak it, and you don't have a voiceover. So he has to show you on his face what exactly he feels. And for me, the most moving moment in the film, if I may go there, is when you as a spectator, you have no idea, if you didn't know the story, you have no idea where the story is going. And at some point, you have to have been made aware that Elio is attracted to Oliver in a very physical way. But the movie does not tell you when that happens. You, the viewer, infer it automatically. You probably inferred it from the get-go, but were too afraid to say, this is what I think is going on in this film. Why am I getting this message? And yet nothing at all is telling me this. And this is exactly what happens in the story. You know at the beginning of the story in the novel that he's attracted, but there is no way that you, the reader, will know why or how or when this attraction and what direction it will take.
And you don't say love and you don't say gay.
I don't say either word. I never will say those words because they are labels. And I think the word love, once you use it, you've just basically killed it. Because love is not just love. Love is desire. It is sort of, if there's a touch of desire, there's also recrimination, there's resentment in love. We resent being in love with somebody. And there's all these other emotions that come with it that are far more interesting for a writer than saying, John was in love with Mary.
And similarly, I mean, lust is not a word that crops up.
No, I never use that either. I don't think I do.
Longing, perhaps?
Longing is better than lust because longing tells you that you want something. And I think wanting is the key word. And I don't think I want to use it that often. But want, it's wanting. When you want something from someone, you could want them just physically, you can want them emotionally, you want them for life. But you want something from them and you don't always know. Is it to touch them? Is it to be touched by them? Is it to be touch them for a second and then be done with them? You don't know, but there's a wanting. And wanting for me is a driving force of everything we do. I want to buy this book. I want to buy this CD. I want this. I want this flower. I want this food. Wanting is so powerful. And yet we always use another word because wanting is so simple.
And it is kind of, you've written in so many genres and that wanting, I guess, would be the overarching theme. If there's a governing process, it's that exploration. It's trying to find the heart of the want.
Well, because if I didn't want, I would be dead. I mean, I could be dead and still pretend to be alive, but it's wanting that makes me want to go to places and to, intimate with something. It's the idea of wanting is life, sort of life defining. Otherwise, if you don't want, what is that? What are you doing? I don't want to go to the opera, but I want to buy the CD because the CD is more fun for me than being sitting there. So I have to know this, but I want that opera. I want to hear that tune again and again and again until I stop wanting to hear it.
And for us as the reader, it's you going through that process, which is so fabulous. wanting and sex, you've been married to the same woman
yes.
for 30 years.
Yes.
Your lust is on the page,
yes.
I presume. But writing about sex now in 2018 feels like it's a dangerous thing to do.
Yes, it is. Irony, isn't it? We're post-sexual revolution, and now we have to watch our steps. I have had to watch my step because I've written about a 17-year-old boy who in the United States is a minor. Whatever he wants, he is always going to be the object of predation, not the other way around. So what happens to the desires of a boy who does feel desire? Are they illegitimate? Are they only good if he feels them for someone who is his own age, not older? These kind of issues never would have come up in a different age. But in today's age, we're so fussy. And I'm not for violence. My father would never have said, go with a child and then see what that's like. No, he wouldn't. That's not what I want. But I think that the freedom to expand on desire, whatever desire that desire takes, is becoming more difficult. People judge you. People always ask me, how do you write about gay sex so visibly and at the same time claim to be a married man with the children and so on. So how do your children feel about your writing? What does your wife think? Where does it all stand? And these are issues that I never consider.
And, okay, why do you never consider them?
Because when I start writing, I don't think of those things. I want to explore things. And I want to go to the nitty-gritty. And if the nitty-gritty takes me to sex, it does. I wrote a book about a man and a woman meeting at a party and refusing or thinking not of having sex. Or they could easily have sex. They even say we could have sex. Mm. But they don't want to because they're enjoying this romance, which is absolutely fabulous. So in this particular book, there was no sex. And people faulted me for not having sex in it. Come on already. I know, but I'm enjoying myself. I like the dilation. At the same time, if there is consummation, I like going there too. Mm. And so I'm open-minded about everything.
And if it doesn't necessarily have sex in it, one thing that most of your writing seems to have in it is music.
Yes, thank you. Yes, very much so.
Mm. Can you listen to music while you're writing?
No, I cannot. It is impossible. But I can certainly have heard music and been inspired by the music to... Oh, maybe I should include this. I'd love to include this. This would be a beautiful moment for those people who know the music and who understand what impact it has on the writer and the reader. Those who don't know the music will say, okay, I understand. Today I was discussing the 31st variation by Beethoven. And I said, if you know the variation, it is sublime. It's a beautiful moment between father and son, watching the evening and the dark sky with the lights of Sicily showing on the offing. But if you don't know the music, you take it on faith. If you do know the music, then I've done something fantastic. Mm. It's the most beautiful postcard you can ever take.
Enigma Variations is your latest book. Are you an Elgar fan?
Yes, I do like Elgar. I think his quintet is very little known, not often played, and it's absolutely stunning. And I like, of course, today in the taxi, I heard the cello concerto and I think it was Jacqueline Dupré playing. So it is a fantastic piece of music in the taxi in London, sort of coming here to discuss Enigma Variations. I'm very happy. And I do love, I love the Enigma Variations, and I can tell you by number which ones I like.
You, incidentally, got the only taxi driver in London that wasn't listening to Brexit hate speech, I think.
I know. It was wonderful. And in fact, I asked him what was playing, and he said he didn't know because it was something afterwards. So we Shazammed it, and we found out what it was.
Let's talk about the Enigma Variations.
Sure.
I wonder if you were still... searching for the same thing. Because there are many echoes from your previous book in there.
Yes. It starts with a boy who's 12 years old and who basically mimics what I experienced when I was 9. Very attracted to an older person. He was 17 at the time, and the man that the 12-year-old is attracted to is 27, 28. So there's a big difference. The boy does not know anything about sex, and I wanted that to be made very clear. So, and it's exactly what happened to me. I wanted to be a friend of this person. Now, in retrospect, I have no idea what I wanted. Maybe I would have slept with him. I don't think so. But it might have been where this was leading up to. But I wanted to be his friend. I wanted him to be my brother. I wanted everything to be with him. And so I followed him around and would borrow from him without even speaking to him, you know, his shrimp so that I can fish next to him on the rock. And we never spoke. Okay. Mm-hmm. But this was the seed of both Call Me By Your Name and of Enigma Variations. But Enigma proceeds further, and it's about a man who, it started with the last story, but it's about a man who basically is considering cheating on his partner. So I added a companion piece where his companion is probably cheating on him, and he catches her almost cheating. She's with somebody over lunch at a restaurant. And he fabricates this in his head until he realizes that the man she was with is not her lover. He's actually totally gay. And he himself now, the narrator, becomes interested in him as if there's something going on. Meanwhile, this man who is allegedly about to cheat on his wife and thinks that his wife is cheating on him with this man who now turns out to be gay is himself already courting someone on the tennis courts who is a man. And I love this. This for me is heaven because it opens, all the sluice doors are open and the water is flowing from everywhere. And I love that universe. And so that in the next installment of this tale is a man who runs into the same woman every 4 years at a party. They sleep together. He has another mistress. She has a boyfriend. She's not happy. He now has a boyfriend. She's making fun of the boyfriend, but she accepts him. And they have an episode together out of town. And she tells him, as they're in bed together and are clearly in love with each other, I think you should go back to him because he's right for you. I am not. And it's so I think that this kind of come and go has been my life in everything, in the places I've been to, the books I've read, the people I know, the desires I've nurtured and cradled all my life. It's all there.
Do you know where it's going when you begin?
No, I never know. And I'm always afraid of where it might go. Because, you know, we are all, when you're in a boat in an ocean and you don't have any oars, which is how my life feels. Yes, I know I can go somewhere, but in my psychic life, I am a boat in an ocean with no oars. You don't take risks. You don't move from one place to the other. You say, I hope the wind will take me to the right place because I have no sense of where I'm headed. And when I write, I have no sense of where I'm headed. Absolutely none. And I love that.
Is it cathartic for you? Are you just searching for something within your own life?
I don't know. That's a very good question. I don't know what I'm searching for, but I know that on paper, it is a magnificent travel. I mean, my stories are a travelogue of all the places I might have had, but never will have, but might still happen. And I'm repeating the same sentence because it's key about my whole life. I want it. I don't want it. I hope I get it. I'm afraid I might get it. So I'm not going there. So I stay put. Where do I want to live? New York? Yes and no. Elsewhere, maybe. Do I want to take a risk of moving to, I don't know, Wyoming or Canada or Europe, which I love, but can I stand Europe for more than a week? I don't know. I better stay put in New York then. That's my life.
But what you have given us is this most fantastic journey through your books. André, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
André Assmann, who is the author of Enigma Variations, which is published by Faber, and it's out now. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of Christy Evans, George McDonough and Martha Libri. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, MixClouds or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.